We publish one fantastic long form narrative story every month. So I hope people will like that. And then my personal website is saywarddarby.com. And that's where I've been keeping all of my writing and coverage of the book. And you can also find details about how to order the book there.
We'll post links to both of those on our website, Sayward is spelled SEYWARDDARBY.com. Thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Sayward Darby, editor-in-chief of The Atavist magazine. She previously served as the deputy editor of foreign policy and the online editor and assistant managing editor of The New Republic. She's written for The Atlantic, Washington Post, Elle, and others. We've been talking about her new book, Sisters in Heat, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about GiveGuide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today kicks off what for many is a week of travel and preparation for the U.S. holiday Thanksgiving, this despite a COVID pandemic. But increasingly, those in support of Indigenous rights are referring to the holiday as a day of mourning. Others refer to it as Thanksgiving. Our guest is Jacqueline Keeler, journalist and author with Dene and Dakota Roots. Also, the latest in what are increasingly failed attempts by Donald Trump to hold on to the presidency, even as the administration is finally allowing the Biden-Harris team to access the transition of power process. We speak with law professor, attorney, and author Marjorie Cohn. And the crisis in Ethiopia, causing alarm across the continent of Africa. There are growing concerns about a civil war and are massacres by the African Union, and there is reported to be growing concern in the team of President-elect Joe Biden. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abe, who won a Nobel Prize for bringing peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea, has now unleashed his forces against the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The Tigray Liberation Front have accused the Prime Minister of a power grab and ethnic cleansing of his government of Tigrayan people. What's going on? We speak with African and African American Studies professor, historian, and author Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The head of the General Services Administration finally has recognized President-elect Joe Biden as the apparent winner of the November 3rd election. The recognition triggers the formal start of planning for a transition of power. It came after President Trump suffered yet more legal and procedural defeats in his effort to overturn the election with baseless claims of fraud. General Services Administrator Emily Murphy explained her delayed decision to start the transition process, citing what she called recent developments involving legal challenges and certifications of election results. She acted after Michigan yesterday certified Biden's victory in the battleground state, and a federal judge in Pennsylvania tossed a Trump campaign lawsuit on Saturday seeking to prevent certification in that state. Trump, though, still refuses to concede. In a long series of tweets and retweets this morning, Trump repeated false claims of fraud, hoax, rigged election, fake ballots. Media reports say in recent days, senior Trump aides had encouraged him to allow the transition to begin, telling Trump he didn't need to concede but could no longer justify withholding support to the Biden transition. Biden is preparing to formally announce his foreign policy and national security team to the nation. Many are former Obama administration officials. The picks include former Secretary of State John Kerry to take the lead on combating climate change. Outside the realm of national security and foreign policy, Biden is expected to choose former Fed Chair Janet Yellen as the first woman to serve as Treasury Secretary. Homeland Security Secretary pick Alejandro Mayorkas is a Cuban immigrant who was an architect of the Obama DACA program, providing protection from deportation to young undocumented immigrants brought to this country as children. More from Laura Ross Brown Tellum.
President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris formally announced their nominations to key cabinet positions, many who served in the Obama presidency, but some of those names were leaked already. Ben Johnson, executive director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, supports President-elect Biden's choice to nominate the first Latino and immigrant to head the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas.
The Biden administration is serious about undoing all that has been done on immigration over the last 4 years, so it's a smart choice.
Alejandro Mayorkas was Deputy Homeland Security Secretary from 2013 to 2016. Johnson hopes Biden will act swiftly.
There's not been an executive order that's come out of the Trump administration that isn't worthy of immediate repeal. So every single executive order dealing with immigration should be reversed.
The Dow Jones jumped 300 points on news Biden's Treasury Secretary pick is Janet Yellen, former chair of the Federal Reserve. Avril Haines is named for Director of National Intelligence. If approved, Yellen and Haines would be the first women to fill these roles. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rossbrow Tellum.
Climate justice activists have a mixed reaction to the selection of former Secretary of State John Kerry to serve as the special presidential envoy for climate. Senator Edward Markey, who co-sponsored the Green New Deal, said Kerry understands the climate crisis is the greatest national security threat of our time. He said Kerry will be a tremendous partner to the climate movement in the Biden administration. Greenpeace called Kerry's appointment a positive sign for Biden's intention to integrate climate leadership into every facet of his administration, and said Biden should set up a climate council to act on the substantive changes we need to survive. But Food and Water Action called Kerry a longtime apologist for fossil fuel fracking and a reliable promoter of false climate solutions like market-based carbon trading schemes. Los Angeles County supervisors will discuss a possible stay-at-home order just days before Thanksgiving after a spike of coronavirus cases surpassed a threshold set by Los Angeles public health officials to trigger one. The public health director, Barbara Ferrer, cited what she called an impressive and alarming surge of more than 6,000 new cases in a single day. The mayor of Los Angeles warned that at this rate, LA hospitals won't have any spare beds by Christmas time. Confirmed U.S. coronavirus cases have topped 12.4 million. Confirmed deaths in this country, 257,000. New York City's first and only African-American mayor, David Dinkins, has died at the age of 93. Dinkins broke barriers when he was elected to lead the city in 1989, beating Republican Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani beat him in a rematch in 1993. California Senator Dianne Feinstein says she'll step down from her role as the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Feinstein is giving up the powerful spot after public criticism of her handling of Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, the Senate's number two Democrat, said he will seek to replace Feinstein as the committee's top Democrat. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Today, we're going to kick off our show to the trouble brewing on the continent of Africa, specifically in Ethiopia, an armed conflict in Ethiopia, which is impacting the lands and lives of hundreds of thousands of people. On November 4th, 2020, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abe claimed that militants from the northern Tigray province had attacked a national military base. He responded by dispatching troops to the region, a region which, by the way, is governed by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which was established in 1975, and they are fighting for what it refers to as national liberation for Ethiopia. Days later, in a televised broadcast, Prime Minister Ahmed announced that the Ethiopian military had bombed a weapons depot in the capital of the Tigray province. Let's go to a clip now from CNN to give their perspective rounding up the situation.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has said that concerns that his country will descend further into chaos are unfounded. But with military operations continuing in the northernmost region of Tigray, there are very real fears that the country will descend into all-out civil war. The recent tensions in the north began in August when Abe's government delayed elections because it said the risk of COVID-19 was too high. The Tigray regional government called foul and held elections anyways, setting off an escalation of rhetoric and action between federal officials and the region's leaders. The tension turned into full-blown conflict in early November, with an alleged attack by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, on a federal military base in the region. For the Prime Minister, quote, red line had been crossed and he ordered federal troops into the region. But because the internet, phone lines, and other communication modes have been blacked out, it's very difficult to ascertain just how many people have been killed in the fighting. But remember, this is the same Prime Minister that won a Nobel Peace Prize last year. He's lauded internationally. He managed to negotiate peace with Eritrea, ending a dangerous stalemate following the Ethiopian-Eritrean War that ended in 2000. But peace at home is proving more difficult to achieve. In Ethiopia's federal system, regions, often divided along ethnic lines, have considerable autonomy and run their own police force and militia. When Abe came into power, his appeal was based in part on the concept of medema, or synergy, the belief that Ethiopians should pull together and be united rather than divided by their ethnic differences. The Prime Minister instituted reforms, released political prisoners, but some accused him of a power grab. Regional leaders, especially in Tigray, complained that Abe's promises of a democratic transition were a sham. And when the Prime Minister formed the Prosperity Party, the TPLF refused to join that coalition. It's the first time they haven't had a seat in power since the early 90s. It set up a clash between the central government and Mekele's regional leaders. The Ethiopian parliament has since dissolved the region's leadership, and Abe has arrested opponents. He tweeted that the TPLF has shown criminal hubris and intransigence, and says he's enforcing the country's rule of law. Ethiopia is seen as a critically important ally in the Horn of Africa region for the US, China, and Europe. And the country has often been seen as a bulwark against the otherwise often chaotic region. There has been a sense that international actors continue to support Abe's government, but his problem has never been international friends, but rather divisions at home.
All righty. So I'd like to welcome our guest to discuss all of this, Dr. Gerald Horn, Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, who's written more than 30 books. His most recently published book is The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Dr. Horn, difficult to understand for those who are not expert in the region and following what's going on the continent of Africa. In particular, this, what people are saying is a form of civil war taking place in Ethiopia, with Abiy Ahmed now really threatening to go into the capital. He's given a deadline for the forces opposed to him to surrender. Dr. Horn, first of all, tell us a bit about this Ethiopian prime minister. We know that he is an ally of the West. Is that the case?
Well, generally speaking, but I think it's also fair to say that Abiy Ahmed, the Nobel laureate, who is of Oromo descent, with partial Muslim heritage and partial Christian heritage, is also very close to the People's Republic of China. In fact, China has become a major player in the Ethiopian economy. It's built railways, it's built a stadium, it helped to build the sparkling new headquarters of the African Union, which is headquartered in Addis Ababa, the capital. There are those who go so far as to suggest that Addis Ababa, the once sleepy capital of Ethiopia, is beginning to resemble a version of Doha or Dubai, insofar as the skyscrapers are beginning to line the landscape. I think that this crisis, however, is obviously going to threaten stability in that part of the world, not only in Ethiopia itself, but also in Sudan, neighboring Sudan, which has a fragile government. Recall that it was not so long ago that long-term leader Omar al-Bashir was dislodged, and as a result, the United States and Israel gained leverage over Sudan, which forced Sudan to broker diplomatic ties to Israel. But with thousands and thousands of refugees from Tigray province pouring into Sudan, that's going to obviously burden and weaken the government there. And likewise, Ethiopia's played a role in helping to stabilize neighboring Somalia to the extent that one could say that it remains stable. Obviously, that project similarly will be threatened. I agree with the setup piece that part of the problem is that the Tigrayans, who are only about 6 to 8 million out of a population of 110 million, played an outsized role in the central government in Addis Ababa beginning in the early 1990s, but with Abiy Ahmed coming to power a few years ago, that began to change. The problem for Ethiopia is that a good deal of the military materiel was sited in Tigray, not least because Tigray borders Eritrea, with which Ethiopia had a conflict. And so when you began to have these difficulties between the central government in Addis Ababa and the Tigrayan province, the Tigrayans were well positioned to fight back because of this military materiel that was positioned there. I should also say this is nothing new, this conflict between the provinces and the central government. Keep in mind that Ethiopia is the home of about 80 different ethnic groups, about 10 different regions. Keeping those ethnic groups and regions in line has been a problem going back to Menelik at the beginning of the 20th century and going back to the regime that preceded the Tigrayans coming to power in the 1990s, speaking of Mengistu Haile Mariam, who styled himself as a leftist. And so even if the Ahmed government is able to weaken this resistance in Tigray and, in fact, squash it, I don't think this problem is going away anytime soon. And in any case, we should know as soon as this week, perhaps, if Mr. Ahmed will be successful.
Yeah, and I mean, there are reports of the Ethiopian government rounding up ethnic Tigrayan security forces that are deployed in United Nations and African peacekeeping missions abroad and forcing them to return to Addis Ababa, the capital, the Ethiopian capital, and of course threatening to basically overrun the capital of the Tigray region. And Dr. Horn, for those of us not familiar, I mean, it is not unusual. In fact, the way things have worked in Ethiopia is that ethnic groups do have some level of autonomy, including control over the police forces, etc. And when this prime minister came into power under what the Tigrayan people are saying was a power grab, he also started a kind of ethnic cleansing of Tigrayan people from his government. So this is causing quite a lot of tension here. And a lot of refugees are fleeing, women and children in particular. Anytime there is war going on, always the first to suffer the civilian toll. But tell us a little bit about that in terms of how Ethiopia is organized with these ethnic groupings and the move that the present government made to get Tigrayan people as much as possible out of his government. Dr. Horn.
Well, it's a very complicated scenario, and we would be remiss if we ignored the ugly hand of outside powers, not only historically. I mean, for example, we know that when the Italians invaded Ethiopia in the 1930s and preceded that by an invasion of the 1990s, they invaded via the coastal regions and established a foothold in what is now Eritrea, and that helped to create conflicts and contradictions that led Eritrea to ultimately rebel against Ethiopia and separate itself from Ethiopia about 30 years ago. The impact and imprint of Italian intervention and colonialism in that part of Africa is no better evidenced by the fact that probably the best cappuccinos you can find outside of Rome are in Eritrea. Likewise, it's interesting to note that even if the Ahmed government is able to suppress this rebellion in Tigray province, before that, the headlines we were reading were about the restiveness in his own Oromo region, which by some measures constitutes a plurality of the entire population. And then historically, the Amhara group has been a dominant group within Ethiopia, and they were not very happy when the Tigrayans rose to power in the 1990s. And I should also say that the United States, under the Trump regime, has not been very helpful. Recall that it was only days ago that as a result of the conflict between Egypt and Ethiopia about Ethiopia building a dam at the source of the Nile River, which Egypt claims is threatening its lifeblood, speaking of the Nile River, that Mr. Trump suggested that his ally, General al-Sisi in Cairo, his favorite dictator, as he once called him, should bomb Ethiopia. And it's suspected that Cairo might have a hand in helping to stir up this present conflict in Ethiopia with the aim of weakening Ethiopia, throwing it off its game, perhaps slowing down the building of this dam or wrecking the building of this dam altogether. So this is a very serious crisis with very diverse players. And once again, even if the Tigrayans don't meet the 72-hour deadline by tomorrow morning to surrender, I'm afraid to say that this situation will be percolating for weeks, if not months, to come.
Yeah, and there's, a couple of other things. One is the attack on the head of the World Health Organization by the government, the present government of Ethiopia. And also, looking at the history of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, they are a political party. They were established, as far as we could tell, in 1975. And it's grown into a powerful liberation movement in Ethiopia. And it seemed to have some kind of alliance with the Eritrean People's Liberation Front that overthrew the People's Democratic Republic of Ethiopia and established a new government back in 1991 that ruled until relatively recently. So I imagine that some of this background and you think there is some nervousness on the part of the present government in Ethiopia, having brokered this peace for this long-standing war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, that is all part and parcel of this onslaught against the Tigrayan people. Dr. Horn.
Well, I think it's fair to say that there was a connection between the secession of Eritrea from Ethiopia in the 1990s and the coming to power of neighboring Tigrayans and Addis Ababa, the central government, at the same particular moment. However, the relationship has soured since then. In fact, the Eritreans have claimed that the Tigrayans, in this recent conflict, have been shooting missiles into Eritrea. And the Tigrayans, in turn, have charged that as a result of this entente between Ethiopia and Eritrea, as evidenced by Abiy Ahmed winning the Nobel Peace Prize, that Tigray is in a kind of nutcracker, with Eritrea pressing from one end and the central government in Addis Ababa pressing from the other end. Now, with regard to Dr. Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, it's a matter of public record that he was a foreign minister under the Tigrayan-led government that was forced out of power by the rise of Abiy Ahmed. He was a health minister before then. He was a member of the Central Committee of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. But he denies sternly and stridently the accusation that somehow he is involved in this present conflict, up to and including helping to finance arms purchases by his fellow Tigrayans. You should know that it was just a few days ago on the suspect editorial page of the Wall Street Journal that those charges were rehearsed and rehashed. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal writer suggested that if Mr. Biden, the president-elect of the United States, comes into power in January, as we expect him to do, and seeks to re-enter the World Health Organization, as he is pledged to do, that a condition should be that he asks Dr. Tedros to step down, which would be seen widely as a step backward, akin to throwing the airplane pilot out of the plane in the middle of a flight, because of Dr. Tedros' central role in fighting COVID-19 and this pandemic. So that is just one more aspect of how this crisis is reaching beyond the borders of Tigray province and beyond the borders of Ethiopia itself. And I should also add the historical note, which is that we all know that Ethiopia has been central to the dreams and aspirations of peoples of African descent in this hemisphere. Recall that the Rastafarian religion, of which Bob Marley of Jamaica was an inherent, has roots in Ethiopia. Recall that when the aforementioned Italian invasion of Ethiopia took place in the 1930s, you had many Black Americans who flocked to Ethiopia to fight on behalf of the sovereign state of Ethiopia, one of the few, along with Liberia, on the African continent, mostly colonized at that particular moment. And indeed, Ethiopian Airways, which is the leading carrier on the continent to this very day, knitting together this Pan-African network, was basically started by Black Americans, including John Robinson, by way of Mississippi and Chicago. So Ethiopia has had historic importance, and given the fact that it's the second most populous nation on the African continent, second only to Nigeria, it will continue to have outsized importance on the African continent and in the Pan-African world.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that the present government seemed to be allied both with China, as you say, and the United States is said that it's also an important ally of the United States, right on the Horn of Africa. And you do have, I mean, the November 9th massacre that took place, the Maicadra massacre that was verified, the death toll unclear according to Amnesty International, but Reuters is reporting that some of the statements from refugees who escaped the massacre said that anyone who said they were of Tigrayan were basically killed and money, cattle, etc., stolen. So you find the usual, sadly, nastiness that happens in war and these kinds of conflicts. And then to add to it, Dr. Horn, there is also the Oromo people. And they broke out in protests this spring. So, the conflicts with among ethnic groups, and the worry, of course, is how that's going to be exploited by external forces, but also the huge price that civilian forces, civilian people will play on all this. Just your final thoughts here.
Well, it's often said that Ethiopia is too big to fail, being the second most populous nation on the African continent, given its influence in the Pan-African world, and given the fact that these ethnic conflicts could tear the nation apart, replicating what befell Yugoslavia in the 1980s and the 1990s after the death of its longtime leader, Marshal Tito. That is to say, you recall, I'm sure, the bloodshed between and among Serbs and Croats and Slovenians and Macedonians and all the rest. And one of the complications as we speak is that there are strained relations between Ethiopia, not only Ethiopia and Egypt, but Ethiopia and Saudi Arabia, which is right across the Red Sea. There have been credible charges of mistreatment of Ethiopians in Saudi Arabia. Keep in mind as well that the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Yemen is heating up, and there is suspicion by the Saudis that the Ethiopians are not necessarily on the side of the Saudis with regard to this conflict. And so this war, and I think that's the appropriate descriptor to use in terms of this conflict, could have mushrooming impact and mushrooming influence that could be quite destabilizing, not only in terms of Africa, but across the Red Sea as well, with regards to Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Right. Well, on that note, we'll continue to keep an eye on that. And we're fortunate, Dr. Horn, to have you to be able to help us to understand all of what's happening there. Thank you so much, Dr. Gerald Horn.
Thank you.
All righty. We are going to take our station break, and coming up, Thanksgiving or Thanks-taking, a day of mourning, Jacqueline Keeler will be joining us, and that will be followed by Marjorie Cohen on Trump's legal battle. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Everybody, wake up. Alrighty, and that station break song, Wake Up by Russell Taylor. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook and check out our website at sotrueradio.org. We have a community calendar there. We have videos, lots of stories we can't get to on the air. And we are our handle on Instagram and Twitter at sotrueradio. And we're also worldwide and nationwide on SoundCloud. And today I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Orlando, Florida. And internationally, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Finland. Yes, we do have some in Finland. And this is the host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. And we are now going to turn our attention to a lot of people this week. The CDC has advised people not to travel. not to group together for the U.S. holiday, United States holiday of Thanksgiving. Nevertheless, the airports are very, very busy. People are traveling, and it seems really ignoring that warning. So there is concern that the numbers of cases of the pandemic will rise, particularly at going into Christmas as deaths will rise. Well, so some people are in mourning. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival yesterday, held car caravans in 36 states. That was declared a day of mourning for the people who died from the pandemic, but also who died from poverty. But increasingly, those who are in support of Indigenous rights are referring to Thanksgiving as a day of mourning. Others refer to it as a thanks-taking. Let's go to a short clip now from Indigenous activist Nick Estes on this thanks-taking and National Day of Mourning.
Everyone knows Thanksgiving is a national holiday for the United States. And actually, I think it was first codified under Franklin Delano Roosevelt to kind of alleviate the suffering of hunger and poverty that people were feeling during the Great Depression, to have this kind of national holiday where families got together and shared food. And so they had to make up something and find something in history to sort of justify it as, you know, all good myths in the United States. And so they chose the third week in November as that date and then pinned it to the Pilgrim mythology, which holds that in the early 1600s, pilgrims from Europe, from England, came over here to start a new life and to escape religious persecution in Europe. And as we know, that was completely false, that they had no intention of escaping religious persecution and finding freedom or creating freedom where they went, but it was actually part of a financial and colonial venture that there was an economic motive behind it. So the pilgrims who departed the Mayflower and founded Plymouth Plantation in 1620 didn't come to be integrated within the existing Indigenous social order. They came to replace it. In 1637, after the slaughter of more than 700 Pequot women, children, and men, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, William Bradford, declared the settlers' first Thanksgiving, the invaders' first Thanksgiving, in which he said, in honor of the bloody victory, thanking God that the battle had been won. And the massacre and its commemoration set the tone for what was to come in the creation of a nation not of immigrants, but a nation of colonizers, right? Because immigrants come to integrate within the existing social order. Settlers come to replace. Colonizers come to replace.
All right, and here to discuss this with us, I'd like to welcome Jacqueline Keeler, journalist and author with Dene and Dakota Roots. She serves as the editor-in-chief of Pollination Magazine, editor of Edge of Mourning, Native Voices Speak for Bears Ears, and creator of the hashtag Not Your Mascot. Jacqueline Keeler also has a book coming out looking at the political divide in the United States and its origins, entitled Stand Off. Jacqueline Keeler, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, Nick has really summed it up quite well. And
Okay. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, though, is that it was codified, okay, FDR, but the Thanksgiving that was proclaimed by Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637, and then Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, called for this national day of celebration, a day of Thanksgiving, in 1863. And, you know, it has developed all of that time. But tell us a bit about this, what some people call this fairy tale of Thanksgiving, some of which we heard in the clip, Jacqueline Keeler.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Nick did a great job of reviewing things, and I think that there is a lot of propaganda that is part of being American, you know, is sort of this massaging of the past, and I've been working on it these today, kind of dealing with the pandemic, Thanksgiving, and what's going on now. And certainly, I don't know. I wrote a piece about Thanksgiving that was in the New York Times years ago. I think I sent you guys a link. And in there, I talk about how the pilgrims gave thanks for the sort of biological warfare that had taken out so many Native people. And of course, the biological warfare went ahead of the actual colonists. And like Nick, I definitely view the United States as still a colony. I give a lecture about how how America is still a colony, in function, if not in stated form, right? And you can predict what the U.S. is going to do based on this definition, because what does a colony do and what does a colonist do? But they basically go to other people's homelands. This is not the homeland of the colonists, and export their wealth to their ruling class, to their 1%. And certainly we saw this at Standing Rock with the choice of supporting pipelines through our territories. That pipeline was going through unceded land, which means under treaty the U.S. has no legal right to that land that it occupies in that part of North Dakota. And so there is, I think that the story that's being told at that Thanksgiving, the way it's taught to children in the United States, is that there was this moment of accord, which if only Indian people had continued to come to the table with the white people, that maybe Manifest Destiny could have carried out in a less lethal way, right? But as Nick notes, their goal here was to basically supplant and to eliminate the already existing social order. And one of the things I note in my lectures is that we are sovereign nations within the United States. We're the only ethnic group that has a political reality that has a component to it. So we have treaties with the U.S. Of course, only sovereign nations enter into treaties with one another. These treaties are ratified by the Senate. So we have a standing that precedes the United States' standing as a nation. Some of the first treaties signed with the United States were signed with Native nations, before they were recognized by Europe. So what I see as sort of the issue is the political disappearance of Native people, and this idea that we could be absorbed by the colonial project. And one of the things in my lecture about the U.S. still being a colony is I turn to my audience, who are of course mostly well-meaning people and Americans, and I say, you are a colonist, right? And so, but you're a good person, a moral person. What would ethical colonialism look like? What would it look like? And because that's a real question that actually this whole situation begs. And I think if you look at the statistical sort of outcomes for Native people, we have the highest rates of murder and rape and suicide, but the Indian wars are still going on. And with the COVID, of course, Native people have a podcast that I run through Pollination Magazine, and we did a whole series on how COVID was impacting Native people. We did over 40 episodes, in the past year. I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My father is Yankton Sioux, and I'm actually kind of related to Nick Astes, I should say. I think that to see how devastating it is COVID has been to Native nations, and how seriously Native nations have taken the science and implemented them with really some of the most severe lockdown in the United States proper. The Navajo Nation is presently under a 31-day lockdown to keep it at bay, and they've been doing this since April. Every weekend doing 57-hour lockdowns. And of course, we did a show interviewing The chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, which is the largest reservation in South Dakota, and Harold Frazier, and he, of course, his tribe was doing COVID checkpoints. And, of course, Governor Kristi Noem, you know, was opposed to the tribes exerting their sovereignty in this way by having checkpoints at their borders. And she tried to sort of tell on them to President Trump and get Trump to order them to stop. I think her goal was to make sure that these tribes were exposed to COVID. And, of course, later she okayed the Sturgis rally, which was, of course, a major spreader. And of course, now South Dakota and North Dakota have the highest rates in the world for COVID and for death rates as well. And so, but the tribes have been worked really hard to protect their population and to make sure that Native people are safe.
Yeah, and Jacqueline, we just have literally a few minutes left here, and what you have described is what is happening today, a kind of a continued slow motion or not so slow motion genocide. But, you know, I have heard this story that in 1637, members of the Pequot Nation had gathered to celebrate the Green Corn Festival, and that 700 men, women, and children came together for the celebration. As they were sleeping just before the sun rose, they were surrounded by these so-named English pilgrims, and all of them were massacred. Tell us a bit about this story, because it seemed as though the following day, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony then declared a day of Thanksgiving. So it seems as though that first declaration of Thanksgiving was, to me, sounds like a celebration of a massacre of 700 men, women, and children, and the beginning of the genocidal wars, really, that happened across the what is now known as the United States. Just your final thoughts on this. Is this a story that you have also heard? And any final thoughts before we have to wrap up, Jacqueline Keeler?
Yeah, I think that in my book Standoffs, I take a real long-term historical look at the origins of these mythologies or this propaganda the United States has cloaked itself in, which has led to sort of the far right sort of armed response that we see today, and I contrast that with the Lakota Dakota sort of history and response to kind of exemplified by Standing Rock. And yeah, I go deep into the history, and I go all the way back to Jamestown as well, which actually preceded Plymouth, and was actually, one of the things I make point of is that the Plymouth Rock origin story, of course, has a religious component, but really it was as Nick was saying, it was a commercial thing, So the U.S. is definitely based in some of the earliest capitalistic sort of exploits. Most of the early colonies were, in fact, corporations, joint stock companies, and they were driven by profit. And so you see this sort of behavior very early on, because the goal. And of course, he gets into the whole discussion of the Doctrine of Discovery, the goal has been the political elimination of Native people and our rights to the land. This is what endangers our lives even today, is that we have rights, legal rights to the land. And so I think that, to me, the solution would be full political recognition of Native nations. And I've been pushing for this thing, which I call the federal indigenous government, which would stand and work on our behalf in opposition to the federal colonial government, and so which is the U.S. government.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, on that note, know a number of our listeners, some, of course, will be gathering, hopefully, with just their pod or people that they're living with now, and keeping COVID in mind. And as Dr. Fauci said, you have a huge Thanksgiving celebration this year. Come Christmas, some of those people at your table may very well not have made it. So we have to take all of this seriously. And Jacqueline, you're absolutely right. The huge price that Indigenous people have paying now for COVID, and others will be marking Thursday, the official U.S. holiday, as a national day of mourning, including myself. So, Jacqueline Keeler, thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Yeah, thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourn Truth. We're going to wrap our show up now. Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, taught for several decades, former president of the Lawyers Guild, criminal defense attorney, legal scholar, political analyst, prolific writer of books and articles, and her work appears on a wide range of media outlets, from the Huffington Post to Truthout, Portside, Alternate, BBC, and much more. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
Okay, so just a really tiny clip here, a short 34 seconds from CBS Philadelphia.
President Trump is appealing a federal judge's ruling dismissing his efforts to block the Pennsylvania vote. A federal judge last night in Pennsylvania's Middle Federal District refused to stop officials from certifying election results showing President-elect Joe Biden winning the state by more than 80,000 votes. The judge rejected the Trump campaign's claims of widespread irregularities with those mail-in ballots. The ruling clears Pennsylvania to certify the results tomorrow. The Trump campaign will now take its case to the Third Circuit of the federal court system.
So, Marjorie Cohn, despite the Pennsylvania Supreme Court dealing the Trump campaign another legal blow, ruling that mail-in ballots cast in the state's presidential election can be counted even if a voter failed to completely fill out the return envelope, and also this comes after a federal judge's decision to dismiss the campaign's request to block certification of votes, and now we have Michigan that has certified despite all of the pressure by the Trump administration. But nevertheless, Marjorie Cohn, Trump campaign, they're saying they're going to appeal this, and there still seems to be some idea that they will go take this to the Supreme Court and perhaps pull out a victory there. Marjorie Cohn.
Yes, Margaret, I think at this point that's not going to happen. As these states certify the vote tallies for Biden, Michigan, after Michigan was you know, pressured, some of the Republicans were pressured by Trump. He called them on the phone. They changed their votes. Eventually, Michigan did certify their votes. Pennsylvania, the counties resisted Trump's pressure not to certify, and the counties have all certified the vote, and it's just a formality that the state certifies regardless of Trump's last-ditch efforts in the courts. And the courts have roundly rejected almost everything that he's brought to them, and some judges really lambasting them for frivolous allegations. You notice that they're not alleging fraud in these lawsuits because they know they can't support fraud, even though Trump's been screaming about fraud for months, fraud for mail-in ballots. Interestingly, so I just don't, and I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to want to touch this with a 10-foot pole, even the right wingers, because the law is very clear that by December 8th, which is the safe harbor deadline, if the states certify the election results in this case for Biden, then that's it. What Trump's strategy was to try to get courts to, you know, by raising these frivolous allegations, get courts to stop the certification of the vote in various states so that they could eventually send competing slates of electors to the Electoral College and eventually to the Congress through Mike Pence, which would be some for Trump and some for Biden. And they were hoping that neither one would get a majority. If Trump didn't get a majority, then it would go into the House of Representatives. There are more red states than blue states. They could win in the House. And if there was a constitutional crisis, which Trump was trying mightily to create, then it could get to the Supreme Court, but I just don't see it happening. I really don't. And particularly because Trump has now given the green light to go ahead with the transition after 2 weeks after the election was called for Joe Biden. And that came on the heels of 100 CEOs. Money talks, right? 100 CEOs said, hey, let's move on and transition to Biden. But interestingly, the strategy of the Trump campaign in trying to undercut the will of the voters really focused on counties or cities rather with large populations of black voters, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Detroit, which Reverend Barber said, they would say Democrat-led city, and Reverend Barber said that's code for black. They're coupling mm-hmm. city and fraud, and that's really been their strategy all along. And it's not surprising because Trump's entire presidency, pre-presidency, for years before the presidency, has been appealing to racism and white supremacy.
Absolutely, and really criminalizing, to me, the black voter. I mean, you're absolutely right to underscore that point. And by the way, this, now that they're finally allowing, this Emily Murphy, who has now approved the transition in what the media are describing as an unusually personal letter to Biden. And by the way, it wasn't the Office of Budget and Management. It is from the GSA agency. I think I mentioned that earlier. So at least now the transition is beginning. As you say, hopefully you're absolutely right. I'll keep fingers and toes crossed that the Supreme Court will absolutely stay out of it. But I wondered, too, if you had any thoughts on the transition as it is looking now. Right, because there's all these court battles going on, and people may not be paying enough attention to what Biden is actually doing right now. Do you know what I mean? There's some concern on the part of some progressives of some of the cabinet members he's proposed.
That's true, Margaret. I just published an article yesterday on Truthout called "Biden's Victory Does Not Guarantee a Progressive Agenda. We Must Fight for It." And, you know, progressives were blamed by the centrists in the Democratic Party for the closeness of the election, not getting more House seats, not decisively taking the Senate. And, in fact, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, set them straight and said that in, all the states that all the places where people supported Medicare for All, Biden won. Let's look at his cabinet appointments. They're a mixed bag. On the one hand, he selected Linda Thomas Greenfield as ambassador to the UN. She was Obama's assistant secretary of state for African Affairs. Ilhan Omar says she's terrific. She looks very promising. On the other hand, Biden's choice for Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, who was Obama's deputy national security advisor, is a very worrisome pick. He was instrumental in formulating Biden's support for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Blinken recently said that Biden would not tie military assistance to Israel to any political decisions that it makes, period, full stop. You know, that means that regardless of the illegal occupation, the egregious human rights violations, the apartheid, the torture, all of that, and Blinken said he would not return, he doesn't want to return the U.S. Embassy to Tel Aviv from Jerusalem, which is also really, concerning. Of course, Biden ultimately calls the shots, but the Secretary of State supposed to be the chief diplomat, and you have kind of a warmonger here as Secretary of State. And then John Kerry is climate envoy, mixed reviews. He could have found somebody younger involved in the climate movement. Avril Haines as department as director of national intelligence. She is former CIA deputy director under Obama, and she was the one who orchestrated the drone strikes during the Obama administration. And then we have Alejandro Mayorkas as head of Department of Homeland Security, who was deputy Department of Homeland Security secretary under Obama. He, to his credit, is responsible for the DACA program and for steps to normalize relations with Cuba. So you know, he could be good. He's that's particularly important because he is of Cuban heritage. And then Jake Sullivan as a national security advisor. To his credit, he was instrumental in getting the Iran nuclear deal to go through, which hopefully Biden will rejoin. And what's probably one of the most worrisome things going on right now, Margaret, is that Pompeo, Netanyahu, and bin Salman from Saudi Arabia all met secretly, which is very unusual that they would meet. And, unusual that bin Salman would meet with Israel. And there is a tremendous U.S. military force heading toward that area, the Middle East. And so it looks like Trump may be planning to invade or attack Iran, and the nuclear facilities, and that could start a huge conflagration. And he wants to interfere with Biden in every way he can, just like he wanted to interfere with everything Obama did. And so he wants to prevent Biden from pursuing diplomacy with Iran because Israel considers Iran an existential threat, which it is not. Doesn't have a nuclear program and has not, you know, invaded any country in 200 years. So that's very worrisome. There's a lot of things going on right now.
Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there, Marjorie Cohn, but I really encourage our listeners to go to Truth Out and where you could read Marjorie Cohn's article and much more. They do really great work over there. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so very much for joining us. We're out of time, sadly.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
All righty. Okay, so we are out of time, and today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank Lizette Tapia, who is the audio engineer, assistant producer Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to the Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please, stay safe now.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Hey KBOO listeners, want a chance to win a $500 shopping spree to Pals Books?